All right, here we go.
Pac-12 fans, this one's for you.
Put your hands up!
This is the Pac-12 Apostles.
Keeping it real.
And only the truth lives here.
Pac-12 Apostles.
The NCAA men's and women's tournament is in full swing. And the Pac-12's disrespect continues for the men despite having four teams in the Sweet 16. USC fans and Evan Mobley believe Oregon stole the Pac-12 championship from them. That makes no sense. The NCAA tournament will provide a nice cash infusion to the conference, and we need it. Sedona Prince blows the lid off of Mark Emmert and the hypocrisy. Legitimate question for you guys. Who's the better leader? Larry Scott or Mark Emmert? And we, of course, we're going to read our reviews and text messages. And Oregon State's president resigned. There were scandals and allegations. And we have an interview with Cal offensive coordinator Bill Musgrave. I'm George Reister. He's Ralph Amsden. And this is the Pac-12 Apostles. You guys can hit us up on the secret text Oso line, 818-293-7547, 818-293-7547, or you can shoot us an email. I'm at I-M-M-A-D at unafraidshow.com. Make sure that you listen to us as well on the Right or Wrong podcast and me on Mad Dog Sports Radio Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. Pacific, and Fox Sports Radio, 2 p.m. on Sundays. So, Ralph, the Pac-12 is the men are 9-1 as we speak. The women are what, 5-1?
5-1
as we speak. 14-2. Yo, I'm excited about what's going on in the tournament.
All right, so the most important question at this point, George, which one of us is giving the best I told you so?
Me.
Clearly. Oh, really? Why?
First thing is in my bracket, the only team that let me down is the team that you can, that you just mind game me into changing my pick. So I had Colorado losing in the first round. George, stick with your gut. Nope, but I went with the peanut butter chocolate crowd. And
peanut butter chocolate crowd.
That's literally their, that's almost their colors. They got like peanut butter chocolate. And I went with that and I should have gone against it. They blew out Georgetown. Now I was like, okay, I feel better because some kind of way I had them losing in the first round to Georgetown in a 5-12 upset. So all of a sudden they ended up in my final four. Thanks, Ralph. And I told you Oregon State was going to win, and okay. They did.
Okay.
I picked Oregon. I picked Oregon to win, picked them playing USC in this round, got Oregon winning in it. And who else did I miss? So I got Oregon State. Yeah. Okay. So I got a big I told you so.
All right. What about me guaranteeing that all five Pac-12 teams would get a win.
Didn't you pick against Oregon State?
In round two against Oklahoma State. So after that guarantee, everything goes to crap. Like, I'm not going to claim any success. Because okay. I don't think I think in my bracket, I'm not sure I had very many actual Pac-12 teams in the Sweet 16. So, I mean, but I did guarantee one win for everybody at the very least.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, you got there. And just in case you are wondering, here's what Ralph has in his bracket. In his Sweet 16, he had, dude, this is absurd. You had Gonzaga versus Santa Barbara.
Okay, my bad.
USC versus Kansas. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Oregon versus Kansas.
Okay. I was very wrong about that.
You had Michigan versus Colorado.
Okay.
You had
All right. So I did have Colorado winning two games.
Yeah, and then you had BYU versus Alabama.
Right.
You had San Diego State versus Houston. Illinois versus Oklahoma State.
Not happening.
Arkansas versus Ohio State.
Okay, still alive, kind of.
And you have Baylor versus Villanova. So, listen, you got two of the matchups right.
Okay. All right. Well, I think three of my four Final Four teams are alive. I feel pretty good about that with how wacky everything is right now. But the thing that I'm happiest about is that that 1/4 of the college basketball teams that are still alive right now in the NCAA tournament on the men's side are all in the Pac-12, which brings us.
I want to point out, though, that the Pac-10 is undefeated.
Are we doing this? Are we doing this?
Pac-10
really?
Is undefeated.
Come on now. You went from this is so weird to me that you went from poo-pooing Colorado to championing Colorado to now like dismissing their relevance within the Pac-12 altogether, all within the span of 5 days.
You lost. You're dead to me.
Come on now.
First of all, they blew my bracket. And they got absolutely housed, bro. They got the literal shit kicked out of them by Florida State.
Okay.
It was bad. It was a terrible showing for the conference, who's been so dominant. I could have dealt with a close loss. I need you to be competitive, though. But after the Pac-12's average margin of victory in the first two rounds is like 14 points. 14 points over 9 victories. And the Pac-12 is still getting no respect. No respect.
What do you think of Colorado losing the Pac-12 conference tournament championship to Oregon State, which netted the conference an extra $6 million with their two wins in the tournament? What do you think of that?
Bruh.
So are you still mad at Colorado now that everybody's rolling in the cash thanks to the Buffaloes?
Listen, they should. Yes, because that could potentially mess up my own cash. No, but I am happy.
Let me read McKinley Wright's statement, because I think he's a class act. He represented Colorado very well, and he's going to go down in history as one of their best point guards of all time. So he said, "Damn, man, Colorado, I just want to say thank you. The best 4 years of my life have been spent here. Y'all welcomed a skinny 6-foot point guard from Minneapolis with open arms. I'm so thankful for my brothers that I've come across over my time spent here. Y'all made this home for me to the point where I rarely went home back to Minnesota so I could stay out of any trouble. I gave you guys everything I had for 4 years and will miss this university. I'm excited for what the future holds, but heartbroken that I'll never play a game for y'all again. I've created lifelong memories with my dogs and made some of my best friends here. I love y'all for life, 25 out." What do you think of that?
I think that's classy. I think it's classy. You know, I mean, I don't have anything bad to say about the dude. Like, it's been a walking bucket. He's been a good player for them. You know, he's like Luka Garza at Iowa.
Yeah, you know what I like about him? That he spent the last couple of days before the tournament retweeting everybody who hashtagged not NCAA property.
I like – and
he's
then
a good
he
dude.
Gets it too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but – okay, so the NCAA – well, ESPN, they reseeded the tournament. They reseeded the tournament because they were like, yo, let's rank, essentially rank the 16 teams left. They have stop me when you have a problem, Ralph, all right?
Okay.
Gonzaga 1, Baylor 2, Michigan 3, Alabama 4, Loyola 5.
Ooh, whoa.
Villanova 6. Florida State 7, Syracuse 8, Houston 9, Arkansas 10,
what?
Oral Roberts 11,
What?
USC 12, Oregon 13, Oregon State 14, UCLA 15, and Creighton 16.
Who did this? Who did this?
ESPN. Hold on. Let me tell you who the writer was. It was Myron Metcalf.
Oh, Myron. What are you doing? We just watched Oregon drop 95 without breaking a sweat. Myron.
Against the conference that everybody said was unbeatable in the Big Ten. The Big Ten got 9 teams in the NCAA tournament. Only one made it out of the first weekend, and that's Michigan.
Oh,
the majority
Lord.
Of them didn't even make it out of the first round.
It doesn't make sense. Like, Oregon just absolutely embarrassed Iowa. Can we talk about what USC did to Kansas?
Dude, they
that
put
game
them in a headlock.
Should have been stopped at halftime.
They should have. That it reminded me of when my uncle used to put me in wrestling moves when I was young, and he used to make me say uncle, you know,
right.
Or yeah, that's what they should have said. It should have been a mercy stopping. That was, oh dude, they got, I mean, at one point you just felt sorry for him. I was like, yo, Kansas can't do anything. It felt like you were watching the JV playing the varsity.
I don't even know what to say about this.
They lost they beat them by 34 points.
Right. So, and this is what I'm saying. Like, when I say that game should have been stopped at halftime, I'm not saying like throw in the towel boxing style. I'm saying we're in the middle of a pandemic. You're really going to risk COVID over playing the second half of that game? It was over.
They had no chance to win that game. I mean, that was, but this ranking is absurd, dude. It is so absurd. And the actual ranking, I thought the Andy Katz came up with a good one. And mine stands right around his, which is Gonzaga 1, Baylor 2, Oregon 3, Alabama 4, USC 5. I would actually switch USC and Alabama. Michigan 6, Loyola 7, Arkansas 8, Oregon State 9, Syracuse 10, Florida State 11, Houston 12, UCLA 13, Oral Roberts 14, Villanova 15, Creighton 16.
Okay. Man, everybody hates Creighton. Oh, man. Speaking of Creighton, there's a kid who out here in Arizona who's committed to Creighton, and he decommitted when all that stuff went down with their coach. And I don't know. It's very possible that some of the players on the team are steering people away from coming out there. So they got to get that fixed real quick. But they say winning cures everything, George. And Creighton's out there in the Sweet 16 with all these bottom feeding Pac-12 teams, according to Myron Metcalf. So we'll just say that Creighton's in good company at the bottom of the barrel for the Pac-12 teams that he ranked, what, 12, 13, 14, and 15?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Dude, it is.
We got to get Myron on the show now. Like,
yes.
We need, I think if the current ratio of 1/4 of the teams continues into the Elite Eight, which he's saying will not happen with his rankings. He is saying that it will not happen. So
okay. So we
they're going to get one.
There will guaranteed be a Pac-12 team playing Gonzaga. Guaranteed. It will either be Oregon or it will be USC. And truthfully, I mean, dude, if the remember, I said this. I was like, I think that USC that they're a team that I thought that could win the national championship because they're so damn big, dude. I mean, they look like the Monstars out there. They got basically 2 7-footers out there. And well, actually 3, really. And I'm sitting there like, and when they take the point guard out and put the other kid in, the smallest guy on the court is like 6'6 or 6'7. The smallest guy and the biggest one 7 feet tall. So I thought that they had a chance. I think that this Oregon team has just shown like, whoa, we can score points. Duarte and Richardson are completely underrated. And I just think that that's the national narrative about the Pac-12 is that people don't watch it as closely as they assume, as closely as they say. And when you're only judged by your, because this year in particular, people were only judged by their conference play. So right. For the most part. And then when you add in COVID issues, you don't remember how many people were healthy during that, whether they had had a pause, how much practice time. I just thought the Pac-12 got a really, really bad rap, and they're showing something else right now.
I think life was definitely harder for a lot of the Pac-12 teams and players comparatively than a lot of other people who had less travel, less COVID restrictions within their state, and less caution within the conference in general. So when you come to NCAA tournament time, all of that adversity, I think, has helped build up the character that you see in a lot of these teams right now. So I think it's all kind of working for the greater good at this point. And I would say that if we continue this ratio into the Elite Eight, if there's at least two Pac-12 teams in the Elite Eight, then that's something that it cannot be ignored, George. It would be nice to get somebody into the Final Four. It's not going to be Colorado like you said it would be, but it would be really nice to get somebody in the Final Four. And at the expense of my bracket, I am willing to sacrifice any monetary gain that I might have for someone to turn around and beat Gonzaga. That would be okay with me.
What if Oregon beats Gonzaga, bro? That would be major. And then do you think the Pac-12 would get credit then or no?
I think so. But then there would be the number of detractors who say, like, see, Gonzaga's not for real. They don't deserve the one seed that they ever get.
Oh, even though they go to the Sweet 16 every single year. I mean, it's stupid. Mark Few's been to the Sweet 16 like six straight years. And he's played in a national championship. They've been to the Final Four. That's craziness. But the Pac-12 has placed four teams in the Sweet 16 three times. 97 with Arizona, UCLA, Cal, and Stanford. That was the year Arizona won it. 98, Arizona, Stanford, Washington, and UCLA. UW is Washington, right?
Yes.
I thought that was a typo. And 2001, oh, come on now. And 2001, Arizona, Stanford, USC, and UCLA. The common denominators here have been UCLA because it's happened again this year. So the question is, what happened to Stanford? Because they were involved in the other three. And okay. What happened to Arizona?
Well, Arizona self-imposed a bit. Who knows if Arizona would have qualified if what they might have been able to put together. I think that would have been really interesting to see. Maybe we got five teams in the Sweet 16. As far as what happened to Stanford, I think they just kind of have ebbs and flows of when they're going to be super competitive. You know, they get a couple of good recruits that you know aren't going to transfer out, and they're able to build on them over time. Then things can work out really, really well for them. I don't ever really worry about Stanford all that much because they're not susceptible to the transfer culture that a lot of these other schools are. So they kind of have a slow build and then a dip and then a slow build and a dip. So I think just this year, Stanford was, in a little bit of a dip mode. I expect them to be fine next year.
Okay. All right. How about this idea, though, that Isaiah Mobley has said about Oregon, that they've been on a roll? I don't want to necessarily say they've got luck. They're a good team, but they stole the Pac-12 championship from us.
In football? What is he talking about?
No, he's talking about in basketball. So everybody's like, hold up, what? Okay, so how this even came about is that so there's obviously, we don't even need to get into what happened during the football season, right? But then in basketball, what actually happened is that UCLA and Oregon were scheduled to. So USC believes that by having to play Oregon when they did, they were tired when they played Colorado and Utah, and they lost both games, which then cost them the championship.
Okay.
Because they were tired. So my reaction, that's the whole premise.
My reaction to that is twofold. One, it's really cool that Isaiah Mobley cares about the Pac-12 championship in basketball, because you made the tournament, so it's not really that big of a deal, and you're doing work now. That's great. It's really cool that he cares, because it's not really a thing that I think too many people actually care about, especially when you have the conference tournament, and then once you're in, everything kind of resets. And then my second thought is, like, this year of all years, even though I don't think that the conference, like, title, regular season title matters anyway, it could not matter less. It is – I'm not taking anything that happens this year seriously. In fact, the NCAA tournament to me is – and maybe it's always like this. Maybe I just don't have this perspective in – alternate years and I should. The NCAA tournament doesn't have anything to do with the regular season for me this year. This is a completely separate event that hopefully people were able to do their best preparing for. But I just, this year does not count in the way that other years count. And so cool.
It counts more to me.
Of course. But it, wow. I will say this. Huh? Because Oregon's still in it and Pac-12 teams are still in it.
No, that's not why. The reason why it counts more to me is because of it's been more difficult.
Okay. But at the same time, it's like, how seriously, and I hate to make this about Arizona State, but 2 5-star recruits and then you lose like 9 games to COVID.
Same thing happened to Kentucky. And Duke.
Right. And I get that. And so if you're Arizona State and you're Kentucky, you've got all of a sudden these fans that are trying to treat this like a normal season and saying there needs to be repercussions. There needs to be realignment. There needs to be a redistribution of responsibilities or people getting fired. And I don't necessarily see it as being I don't think the regular consequences should be there. I think you should just celebrate any overcoming of adversity, like that Larry Krystowiak getting fired. If they're going to fire him this year, they should have fired him last year, is my opinion. The consequences.
Well, they couldn't fire him last year because the pandemic happened and it cut the season off. So they didn't even get a chance to play really. So
I don't know. I don't like to tell other people how to run their business. It's just to me personally, I do not feel like this is something that I am taking as seriously. I look at the tournament as a reflection of who was able to best prepare and withstand the adversities, and whoever's left standing in the end, we should celebrate them not as the best team in college basketball, but as the most resilient. And then hopefully next year we're back to things as normal.
Yeah. See, I put a lot of stock in the winners, but less stock in the losers. Less criticism on the losers. Like, I feel like that if the winners, that they should be applauded because they overcame so much, still were able to play well, put it together, all those things. But
yeah,
but for the losers, I don't necessarily think a coach should be fired because of that. So here's the backstory about what happened with USC, Oregon, all of that stuff, because USC fans, they believe that Oregon faked their COVID issues. But what happened is that UCLA and Oregon were scheduled to play on December 23rd in Eugene. The game got postponed because of COVID issues with the officials. The makeup date was January 19th, but the Ducks couldn't play because of COVID. They also canceled their 3-game swing through Los Angeles in late January. 1 game at USC, 2 at UCLA because of the second COVID pause. And the conference eventually, the Pac-12 rearranged for the Ducks and the Bruins to play. And the game was going to be in Eugene. And then Oregon beat UCLA. And then that left them one win from clinching the Pac-12 championship. So that's what happened. But what the USC people are not taking into account is that Oregon went on a COVID pause a week before the first makeup game on July 19th, the one in Eugene. Dana Altman then agreed to play two games at Pauley Pavilion during their upcoming trip on January 28th and then February 1st, which was the makeup game from January 19th. So Dana Altman agreed to give up a home game against UCLA to play it on the road and play three games in 5 days in LA. And okay. He did it knowing that Will Richardson wasn't even going to be back from his thumb surgery yet. So Oregon spent 10 days on pause, lost to Oregon State, and then had to pause again before the LA trip. So, like, this is just, I mean, like, and then they went on pause again. That February 1st game got postponed. And it's just been a disaster. So UCLA agreed to play in Eugene on February 22nd, and then that's how that happened. But then USC fans are trying to, USC fans were trying to blame Oregon, saying, "Oh, that they did this on purpose." But in reality, they went on pause even prior to it, and they scheduled games that were scheduled three games in 5 days, which they ultimately ended up having to do. And USC had to play Oregon before they played Utah and Colorado. This sounds like a bunch of excuses to me, because they just played two games in 2 days in 48 hours, but there wasn't a problem there.
You're a very engaging and entertaining person. I think that's why you've had a lot of success in this business, George, but that was the most boring story I've ever heard in my entire life. Or maybe it's me, but they're going to play. They're going to play each other.
Yeah. Yep.
So who do you have winning?
Okay. My basketball head says that if this is a track meet game, like if Oregon can keep this game out of the half court for the most part, then they should win this game. Or if they can get either of the Mobley brothers in foul trouble. But USC is going to sit in that zone with those big, long, giant bodies, with those long legs, and it's going to be tough to beat if they get into a half court game. But if they can keep it moving up and down, I like Oregon to win a game.
What are the odds on this game? I'm checking right now.
USC's favorite. I got it already. USC's favorite by 1.5. But the Pac-12 is 9-1 against the spread over the whole.
That doesn't mean anything. Thanks. You're killing me. Okay. All right. So I. Oh man, I like Oregon.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah. I like Oregon in this game.
Better chance to upset Gonzaga.
Yeah, I don't know, but I really like Mark Few, and I think that Jalen Suggs being the best freshman in the country, but being the third best player on the team for Gonzaga means
that's wild, that
this
right?
is a really, yeah, I think it means this is a really special year for them. And so if somebody beats them, I think it's a true upset and not a bad seeding or anything like that. I genuinely think that if Myron Metcalf got one thing right, I think it's that Gonzaga is the best team in the entire tournament. And I know that people would want to make an argument for Baylor or whatever, but that's who, honestly, George, that's who I want to see. I would like to, and I know that the odds of something like this happening are, you know, pretty astronomical, but if we ran into a situation where it would have to be a championship, right, where you had Oregon running up or UCLA running up against Baylor, I would love to see a Pac-12 team test that Baylor defense. Because all I ever hear about is that it is legit, and I would love for a Pac-12 team to be responsible for making sure that Baylor never wins again, because I'm still not over some of that crap that they did 10, 15 years ago.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Nothing good for
Ruff
Baylor
does not
ever.
Hold a grudge.
Oh, well, like they try to set up a dude as a drug dealer. I just – and then they hired Ken Starr to be like their university president. I don't have any – yeah, but if Baylor loses, I don't feel bad. That's I don't hate Baylor. I'm not. It's not like a Notre Dame level of hate that people have, hating their existence. But if nothing good ever happens for them, it doesn't bother me at all.
Hold the hell on. I just realized what you did.
What?
So you did something that I would do, and I missed it. Where I just gave everybody the rundown. And so you know how sometimes things land really late sometimes?
Yeah.
I sat there and I gave everybody the history on what happened. And you gave me a compliment and then smacked me with a glove. Like, you're like, hey, George, see, you are a very entertaining, engaging person. That's why you've had so much success in your career. But that was the most boring story I've ever heard in my whole life.
But it's not your fault. I cannot be interested in the mental battle waged over a Pac-12 regular season title in which nobody even played the same amount of games, nor did they get
they
to play
have
each
the
other.
Pac-12 tournament. So then who's more of the champion, Oregon or Oregon State?
I already from year to year can't tell you who wins the Pac-12 regular season title because the conference tournament is the only thing that matters to me. And then if you're good enough to get in, you're good enough to get in. I don't care about, but I will say that I think the disrespect for the Pac-12 that you're talking about, you know, I don't think we're manufacturing it. The Myron Metcalf thing is just one half of it, but UCLA being in the play-in game was disrespectful. It absolutely was.
Yeah.
UCLA for a really long portion of the season was the best team, and then they kind of fell off toward the end. But that same thing happened to Wisconsin, where they were the best team in the Big Ten, and then they fell off, and then they got the respect of being able to be given a 9 seed.
Yep. See, that's the difference. It's because they're like, oh my God, the Big Ten's undefeatable. They're the best thing ever. And then here comes the Big 12, them too.
Yeah,
it's always that is
when North Texas works over Purdue and then gets blown out by Villanova.
Yeah.
Great job seeding the tournament, guys.
Dude, that's 15 teams, right? I'm sorry. That's 9 + 5. Wait, did the Big 12 have – the Big 12 got 6 teams in, right? So that's 15 teams. Out of 15 teams, that's what? That's a little – less than a fourth of the entire tournament field between those two conferences. Only 2 teams still alive in the final 16. All right. The Pac-12 is though going to get, Ralph brought it up, a huge cash infusion from the NCAA tournament. And I'm not going to bore everybody again, but here is the way it works. Every game equals 1 unit, and the units earned are pooled together, and then they're carried forward for the conference for 6 years. So then the Pac-12 receives an annual check from the NCAA based on the number of units collected over the rolling 6-year period. And each unit this year will be worth about $300,000 over the pay cycle. Or so far the Pac-12 has banked 15 units. Well, actually 16 technically, because USC will be playing. I'm sorry. either USC or Oregon will be playing in the next game in the Elite Eight. So that's 16 units already. That's a big deal. So now you're looking at, So that's 16 units. How many is that, Ralph? 16 units times.
Oh, man, I'm a lit major. I'm a literature major. I'm of no help to you here.
Oh, that's 4.8 million total.
Okay.
4.8 million. And that's going to, and that is, and that goes, so to make a long story short, how it works is that then that money is divvied up across every single team throughout the conference. So to make a long story short, each team in the conference is going to get well over almost $3 million a year just from this tournament performance. And I think that is huge for the conference. Huge. Because, I mean, like, that's the buyout of a basketball coach. That's, of the other athletic department revenue. Like, this is huge in a COVID year to have this additional income that's been able to be really good.
Yep. No, it's great. And I, as much as I love Joe Healy, one of the coolest guys I've ever met in my entire life, he is adamantly against Back the Pack. And I'm going to present to you his argument, because I did not actually know that his Back the Pack argument spilled over into basketball. So let me see if I can find this for you. He said, it's my hope and dream that every...
Hold on one second, Ralph. I need like five minutes. Hold on one second.
Sure. So that brings me to this Joe Healy take, because he's probably the most notorious non-Back the Pack guy. He believes very much that that there's limited resources, therefore anybody getting something takes away from you. Like, that's his philosophy. But I didn't understand that Joe Healy's philosophy actually extended into basketball. I thought it was just a football thing as far as rooting for people to win bowl games and everything like that. But he actually put that out there, that he believes it in basketball as well. He said, it's my hope and dream that every Pac-12 team other than Arizona State University always loses every single game of sport it ever plays. To which someone told him, Pac-12 rings the cash register, which benefits all, not anyone's fault other than our own, that we are runners up in everything. And Joe Healy said, yes, but my simple take is shared money doesn't offer a competitive advantage to Arizona State, and individual schools advancing and getting the spotlight helps their recruiting, which gives them a competitive advantage over opponents that include ASU. And the metaphor that he used is said, if it's chess day and there's a guy who can bench 100 pounds more than me, metaphorically Oregon or USC, I don't want there to be two available benches so we can both work and he can maintain that gap. I want there only to be one bench for me so I can close the gap. What do you think of that?
Okay, so that's a nice theory, right? But the true theory is a rising tide lifts all ships, in that means that Arizona State's ceiling is lower, because if the rest of the Pac-12 sucks, recruits don't want to come to the Pac-12. That means that Arizona State's recruiting pool is going to be lower. Here's a quick story. Kyle Brady, when I showed up to Jacksonville, he told me this story. I think I've told it before, but I'll tell the quick version. I remember my rookie year, I made some plays in camp, and Kyle's cheering for me. He was like, yo, G, good job, dude. That was amazing. Like, yo, that was a dope-ass route. That was a great block, great catch. He used to cheer me on, and one day I was like, Kyle, I don't understand. I'm trying to take your spot. Why are you happy for me when I do good things? His response was, he laughed at me. He was like, George, I don't think you get it yet. I was like, no, we're competing for the same job. He was like, yeah, but we're not just competing with me and you. We're competing with everybody else outside of here too. He said, just because if you do bad and I just do a little bit better, that does not mean that I get the job. He said, if we both perform below what they think the standard is, they'll fire both of us and bring new people in. He said, so I don't have to root for your failure, because your failure does not mean my success. That your failure just means that there's going to be a new body coming in. So I want you to do well and me do well. So he was like, because I actually like you. So I just, and I control how well I do. I don't control how well you do. So if I do, and he said, I believe in my heart that if I perform my best, I'm better than you. And you probably believe that if you perform your best, you're better than me. So we don't have to root for the other person's failure, because the other person's failure does not ensure that you succeed. And that's the same thing with the Pac-12. That's why back in the pack is the optimal solution. Look at the SEC. The SEC gets all that ancillary love from everybody. Oh, the SEC is so great. But if you take Alabama out of it, aside from Tim Tebow winning over a decade ago and Cam Newton falling into a national championship, what else do they have? I mean, right. Auburn just fired a coach. Florida went through a drought before Dan Mullen, and this Dan Mullen era hasn't exactly been unscathed either. So it's like the SEC gets so much credit because Alabama's so great.
Yeah, I would say all you have to do is reverse it, and don't make it about money. Make it about recruits. Okay, so everyone in the conference gets a 4-star recruit, you included. Okay, then you have to trust in your school and your system to do the most with that 4-star recruit. Forget what everybody else is doing. You want better recruits so that you can make the most of your situation. And I think if you phrased it that way, then it's not about the money at all. It's you trust your people to do the most with what they get. I think being somebody who is not back the pack means that you don't actually trust your school to do the most with what they get. And in your distrust for your school and their ability, you root for ill to befall everyone else. Now, the other side of that would be some people would just rather be Boise State fans in the Mountain West or Gonzaga fans in the West Coast Conference. And I get that, but we're up here with the big boys and everybody's got resources.
Dude, that was a word right there, Ralph. That was a word.
Thanks. I try.
And yeah, so anybody who's out there that is not back to pack, fix your thinking, man. Fix your thinking, because you are way off base here. The next thing up is the Pac-12 networks. The Pac-12 networks are in a situation where people believe that they should be closed down, that they should be closed up shop, and that the conference needs to rethink everything it does. That's a quote. And the 17% drop over the last 2 years in terms of subscribers. So it used to have 17.9 million. Now it's down 17%. They're down to 15 million. And it keeps falling and falling and falling. And it is actually, sorry, it's down to 14.8 million. And the whole way that they tried to put it together was faulty from the beginning. The idea that you were going to have these separate networks and then the rights were going to be so valuable at the end, that would have made sense for, like, if the winning had happened. But truthfully, I don't even think that would have worked either, because the most important ability in life is availability. And the NFL has given us this model. The NFL, state, like they had more money opportunities in their new TV contract deals to go to streaming only.
Right.
And Amazon would have paid them $200 billion to be able to have the entire NFL network pack, all their games. But instead of taking $200 billion, they're taking $110 billion and making sure that they're available to everybody. That means that means 15 to 17 million viewers every single game. And then in big games, you're going to get up to 20 million. And they know that being on CBS, being on Fox, being on NBC is more important than being on than their Monday night football games on ESPN. But that's why ESPN pays double for their Monday night football package. The SEC did it with CBS. So that's why the Pac-12, when they're negotiating their new TV deal next year, CBS and NBC have to be the answers. They have to be the answers. Anything else, you're going to meet your demise.
True. That's, I don't know, but I don't know a better way to put it. You need literally everything that you can get if you're this conference. So you see the disrespect that it got leading into the tournament, and that comes from a limited ability. I mean, I'm about to experience this. I'm moving to the East Coast, and I already have a limited ability to watch the conference, and I freaking live in Phoenix, right? So, you know, now the deck's going to be completely stacked against me as far as just being able to keep up. And we had Mike Yam on our show last week. And talking about how when he moved out here, he noticed the existence of the East Coast bias, and that it was an actual real thing. And so, you're going, availability is going to be your best ability. I would rather the conference give away games for free than get paid in such a way that would limit people's ability to even see the product.
Yep. 100% agree with that, dude. 100% agree. And people would ask, okay, so what happens to the Olympic sports and all that stuff? Well, I do think that those places should have a home, but those are probably going to have to live on a subscription model, because there are people that do want to watch it. But then maybe the conference subsidizes some of the additional money if that's necessary. But you know, I think that there's one way to do it, and the way the Pac-12 has been doing it has not worked. Now it is time, though, for one of our favorite parts of the show, where we read our reviews. This is one of the best parts. So you guys make sure that you guys continue to leave reviews for the podcast, and because it's fun to read them. And our text messages as well on the Secret Textoso line, 818-293-7547. And we do have new reviews. What do we have, Ralph?
Okay, so we got one from this last Friday. It is from Ducks Win. So I think we can assume what they are a fan of. It says that the title of this review is New Teams to Pac-12/State of Oregon Basketball. And here's the review. It says, you mentioned adding Gonzaga as a basketball only team. By the way, George, it's not pronounced Gonzaga. I would look at San Diego State as well. Heck, I'd look at them as football and basketball edition. Love the pod. Weird you didn't recognize both Oregon and Oregon State men's and women's teams making the Big Dance for the first time in the same year. And this is a 5-star review, and now is our opportunity to actually give both Oregon and Oregon State that recognition of being on the men's side and the women's side. And I think I actually had the women's bracket pulled up, and I know on Rice or Wrong we got very much into the calling out of the NCAA by Oregon women's basketball team and players in general, but I don't know if you wanted to kind of give an update on that, George.
Yeah. So right now, just in the the women's basketball tournament. So Oregon and Oregon State, dude, that's a huge deal. Dude, that is 100% a big deal. For all four teams to still be in the tournament, and the women, both the Oregon women and the Oregon State women won their initial matchup. Now, Oregon State plays South Carolina, which is going to be a tough game, and Oregon plays Georgia, which is going to be a tough game as well. But hopefully they both win, because I back the pack, because it's the right thing to do, backing the pack. So, yeah. So there's that. With the women's tournament, though, I firmly believe that, and I stand by what I said. And that's why the question was asked, is Larry Scott a better leader, or is Mark Emmert, president of the NCAA, a better leader? And I'm sitting there like, yo, Mark Emmert's a clown. Like, he now is talking about, oh, I'm going to take the reins of the investigation about what's going on in the women's tournament. There's the weight room, which we talked about, which their weight room was inadequate. They got 10 dumbbells and the men got tens of squat racks. Oh, George, but women don't lift weights. Yes, they do, Dumbo. They're athletes. Athletes do athlete things. They get stronger. They lift weights. They squat. They clean, they deadlift, they do all of the things. They get on treadmills, all the things that the men do. The women do the same thing to compete at their sports. I mean, insanity. And then there was also the issue of the PCR testing that the men were getting every day versus the testing that the women were getting, which was the antigen testing, which we know for the coronavirus, which we know comes up more false positives. There are false negatives. Like, it's just completely unreliable in terms of the medical community, that they're in terms of definitive about whether to cancel a game, cancel, you know, quarantine people. They give them PCR tests after. So why would you give the women anything different?
I think it to me, it's less sexism. I think the end result is sexism. The end result is sexism. It's basically the same exact thing, but it's less sexism and more them worshiping their God, which is the almighty dollar, right? So,
well, the women have a $500 million contract with ESPN. It's not chump change,
but it's not a billion. I think your best. Your best and brightest are always going to go to making sure that you can secure the bag. And I think that they've taken the women for granted. The standard needs to be the standard. If a standard exists for your student athletes, then that needs to be maintained across the board. And there's absolutely no excuse for it. And when it's not maintained across the board, you look at the two things that are different. Thing one is the money, and thing two is the gender. I'm choosing to believe that the NCAA, which is made up of a lot of very highly educated female employees, in addition to just, you know, big bad Mark Emmert or whatever, I'm choosing to believe that this is an issue of they're taking care of the biggest cash cow at the expense of the other cash cow, right? And so that's what I'm choosing to believe. I am not of the belief that people within the NCAA are looking at the female student athletes and saying, ugh, disgusting. Those gross women should be in the kitchen and not out on the basketball court. Therefore, we're going to give them the second best of everything. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that it's just a general culture of taking for granted anything that is not the main driver of attention and finances.
And then there's the issue about the freaking pictures, dude. The pictures. So, like, there are pictures, like, you know when you're writing articles or you attend an event, there are pictures available on the site.
Yes.
And for the men, pictures of the first four, every single game. But then the women's, there aren't pictures or transcripts of the interviews available. So how the hell are you supposed to do the job or cover the tournament properly? The transcripts aren't even available until after the Sweet 16. What?
Absolutely corny. And so what they're telling you is we are allocating resources to what we believe is the biggest deal for us, that draws the most attention, that has the most interest, has the most money involved. And this is a nonprofit that traffics in amateurism. And so that there shouldn't be a difference in treatment. And I'm here to say that, like, any difference in treatment at all is wrong. I don't care how much one person likes one thing over another. I'm wondering how that vibes with your view, George, of, like, when we talk about the Pac-12 and who should be running it, that their priority should be football over everything. But your view is that a rising tide raises all boats, not that other sports should necessarily suffer. So I'm just wondering how you reconcile that view of we're saying that men and women should be the same, but within the Pac-12, one sport should be elevated over all the others.
I think that when you are looking at sports, right, at a school, that and at the conference, football pays for all of the rest of the sports, except for men's and women's. Men's basketball pays for itself, and some women's basketball teams pay for themselves. Some. Aside from that, football pays for everything else. So you have to take care of the money with football if football is failing, because then you are making the other sports suffer. Like, you're literally taking money away from the other sports by football not being properly nurtured and taken care of.
That's what the Pac-12 is going to have to do if it wants to regain some footing on the national landscape. The last thing that we talked about that we were going to bring up today is Oregon State's president. He resigned. He resigned over his name is F. King Alexander. That's a hell of a name. F. King. Effing Alexander. He's stepping down. And he's going to receive a lump sum payment of $670,000 payments for medical and dental insurance for a year. Yep. So he's walking away with a nice little golden parachute. But this came on the heels of what happened at LSU. So prior to being at Oregon State, he was at LSU. He served as chancellor and president from 2013 to 2019. And we know that all those sexual assault cases that were overlooked and all the stuff, like, this is a trickle down from the Les Miles tenure over at LSU. And this was some terrible things that have been alleged to have happened. University knew about them. They didn't fire it. Les Miles, all of this stuff. And Oregon State's like, listen, we don't want no part of that. And that's completely understandable. So he's gone. He's out. Well, sorry. Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you. So now here's the interview with Cal offensive coordinator Bill Musgrave.
You can find him on Twitter at Coach Musgrave. He's the offensive coordinator and quarterback's coach at Cal, the Cal Golden Bears, and my former offensive coordinator when I got to Jacksonville, a longtime NFL and college quarterback coach and offensive coordinator. Coach, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you, George. Great to join you. We had some great times there in Jacksonville. Remember you beating the Tennessee Titans there in Nashville with the shallow cross and running a bunch of good routes. Wish we had you here for the Golden Bears right now.
Oh no, you don't want this version of me. you want the old version. That version is over and done with. There are only memories and pictures to remember all of that. So, but you have been a long time NFL and college coach. Like, how has the game changed in terms of, you know, like, how you have to coach quarterbacks in college now? Like, how has the game changed from, you know, way back in the day to where you're at now?
Well, the rules have changed a little bit to make the game safer, as we've all talked about over the years, which is a good thing. So the quarterbacks don't get hit as much, or after they throw it, they don't get hit and driven into the ground or landed on. So the quarterbacks are staying a little bit more healthy, a little bit more upright. And, of course, the shotgun has been implemented a lot more. Defenses have gotten much more exotic. Back in the 80s and 90s, we could be under center because no defense was really attacking the A-gaps. Now the defenses are bringing people from all directions and safeties and corners and nickels falling out of the sky. The shotgun helps the quarterback, of course, receive the ball and get these passes launched where we can take advantage of more rules, which are, you know, slanted against defensive backs in terms of holding and incidental contact and DPI. So little rule changes, more passing, more shotgun, but it's still fun. As we know, football, really the toughest team usually wins, you know, really does, the toughest team. And whether that's physically tough, mentally tough. So we always are promoting that with our players, but it's more wide open than it used to be. Not so much three yards in a cloud of dust, as we used to say.
Yeah, and as a former quarterback yourself, I bet you would have liked to play in today's game, because a lot of those throws that you didn't used to be able to make because your receiver would literally get his head taken off are now throws that are available to quarterbacks more now?
That's a great point you make. I'd say the seams are more open for business. You're correct. Just because of the rules. And so quarterbacks, play designers are taking more chances and being more aggressive because the rules have evolved a little bit, and probably makes it a more entertaining game for the fan, I would guess.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't necessarily know, but you went to the University of Oregon. You're one of the best quarterbacks to come out of there, and you threw for over 3,000 yards before that was really commonplace. Like, what do you remember about Oregon during that time versus where the university is at now in terms of recruiting and uniforms and everything that you've seen change?
Yeah, Oregon, the Oregon football program has really changed since the 1980s when I was there. It was both in scope, and I'm sure not as many tight margins as we had back then, both financially and everything else. So they've taken it to a flashy level, whereas you're right, when I was there in the 80s, we were excited to receive one pair of cleats and one helmet, and we were going to go play a Pac-10 schedule at that time and try to go toe-to-toe with the big people in the Pac-10. So had a great experience, a lot of great teammates, as you can attest to, and good coaches at that time with Bob Toledo and Rich Brooks, and just outstanding teammates with Derek LaVille as our running back, and a lot of good defenders as well. So it was a good collegiate experience for me.
Yeah, and you guys are doing big things over at Cal now. Like, I'm super excited about Chase Garbers, you guys' quarterback, because I think he's got a bright future, and I thought he made a huge step. I mean, and it's funny because when I say last year, I don't mean like this past football season. I mean 2019. Like, so when I thought that Ole Miss game, he made a big step, and then last year I thought that there were some good parts to it too. I think he can be a really good quarterback and NFL guy too.
I agree. Very bullish on Chase Garbers. And you're right, just with our disjointed season of last year, it was tough to get in a rhythm, but he still battled through. He lined up for every snap for us. And as you said, in 2019, George, he had a whale of a game down there in Oxford, Mississippi. Had more good games, beat UCLA, beat Stanford with a 25-yard run in the last minute, went down and beat UCLA at the end, like we talked about, won a bowl game in the Red Box Bowl versus Lovey Smith in Illinois. So Chase is on the ascent, and really enjoy being associated with him.
Yeah, and you actually, your head coach is a former Oregon Duck in Justin Wilcox. But he's been a defensive, you know, like he's done really well defensively throughout his entire career, and some of his assistants have gone on to the NFL, other places. What's it like coaching with Justin?
Oh, it's great. It's great. His brother was a tight end like you were, Josh Wilcox, there at Oregon. And Justin went in there as a QB, played QB for Dirk Cutter, was there under Coach Bilotti, and then they moved in to be the quarterback of the defense, playing free safety, and started there for 4 years, ended up playing nickel at the end of his career there, playing some corner. So defensively, he knows what he's doing. He also knows offense because he was a quarterback originally. So, as you mentioned, I mean, he's being a defensive coordinator at Boise State when they were rolling and beating everybody under the sun, defensive coordinator at Tennessee, defensive coordinator at Washington, defensive coordinator at SC, defensive coordinator at Wisconsin. So everywhere he's been, I mean, have had real stingy, stout defenses.
I did not realize that Dirk had been at Oregon until you mentioned that. But you went on to go, obviously, be a coach in the NFL, and you had a unique experience because you're an offensive coordinator and then having to switch styles because you coached Michael Vick. And then you were there for the start of Matt Ryan's career. And these dudes are two totally different quarterbacks. How were you, like, what changes did you have to make to the offense? And what was it like adapting to two different styles? I mean, two dramatically different styles of play.
Well, that's, I think, the beauty of coaching and the beauty of teaching is finding really how the individual pupil, the student, the player, how they learn or how they can be successful. And that's really an exciting part, I think, of being a coach is thinking players first and then plays. I think all coaches have their schemes and their concepts and their system and their language, but it's got to be a language or a system that is adaptable to your players' strong suits. And we do a super job here at Cal. We've got a great coaching staff on offense with Aristotle Thompson, Burl Toller III, Angus McClure, and then we just hired Jeep Christ, who's got, you know, over 500 games of the NFL under his belt, coaching and quarterbacks and tight ends and coordinating. We're always talking about our players. You're right. Michael Vick, what are his strong suits? What are his traits that we can engineer the offense and customize and tailor the offense around? So very different than Matt Ryan. And so that's really exciting because there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat.
A lot of people compare Michael Vick to Lamar Jackson now. What do you when you look at, I mean, because you saw Michael Vick up close and personal for years and he was super dynamic. What do you make of that comparison? And do you think that it's fair or do you think that one has different strengths than the other guy?
I got to be around Michael really well. We recruited Marcus, his little brother, when I was at Virginia 20 years ago. So I know Michael and his family really were just outstanding people. And so to be able to coach Michael in Atlanta was a real honor. And he is very talented. I met Lamar at the combine when I was coaching and he came out of Louisville. So we got to interview him. Both of those guys are talented. They're right there in the NFL. They're professional athletes, but both of them are tremendous leaders. And that's why I think they're both successful, because the other 10 guys in the huddle with them or at the line of scrimmage, if they're in no huddle, they're going to put their best foot forward because they believe in them. And a lot of quarterbacking has to do with whether you're authentic, whether you're a leader, whether your teammates believe in you, because it's easy to check out and shut it down if the quarterback's not on top of his trade. And both those guys are on top of their trade. I know Michael was, and then from watching Lamar, of course, you know, from a distance, you can tell the other 10 guys on the field are, you know, willing to risk life and limb, and they're just holding on for the block. They're making the tough catch. They're supporting them because both guys are outstanding people first and then athletes second. And the leadership is really key, of course, to the ultimate team sport, which we're talking about, football.
Yeah, we're on with Bill Musgrave. You can find him on Twitter at Coach Musgrave. He's the offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach over at Cal. Over 20 years of NFL and college quarter coaching experience. So over there at Cal has a great tradition of quarterback play. I mean, Aaron Rodgers, Jared Goff, guy I came out with, Kyle Bowler. And I mean, Steve Bartkowski, Vince Ferragamo, Craig Morton. I mean, when you were looking at jobs that you could potentially take, it did that history factor into it? And how as important is it to you to keep up that legacy?
It's very important. You're right. It's a rich tradition of quarterback play here in Berkeley. So really excited about carrying on that tradition with our current group of guys. And we've got some guys coming in, obviously, in the coming years, hopefully through recruiting. But the guys that are here are doing a nice job of carrying the torch for all those guys that you mentioned, because there's a rich tradition here for the Golden Bears.
Yeah, so it had been a while since you had been, you know, in the college game, since you were in Virginia. I think what was it, 2001, 2002? And yep. Then, yeah, so it had been a while. How has recruiting changed from back then to what you have to do now?
The major change is the film. Back 20 years ago, you had to get the film from the high school coach. He had the film. There was no huddle. There was no digitized film where you just push a button at your computer and you can see every single game under the sun, you know, that a young man has ever played. So that was different recruiting-wise. It's so much better now that we get to see all the games of all the guys in high school. So we're leaving no stone unturned as far as recruiting. So it's much more streamlined now than it was 20 years ago. The players, though, are the same. Just love being around these college guys. I think I'd be happy, George, you know, coaching anywhere. I know I would, at the high school level, the college level, or the professional level. It's just, I love the team sport. I love the teaching component of coaching, and just great to be around such a wonderful slice of humanity.
Yeah. So quarterbacking in terms of, because I'm a high school freshman, and it seems like it's much more competitive now. And you see a lot of guys because there's more quarterback coaches, more specific training. And it seems like that there are guys who I've seen who perform really, really well in what football coaches call underwear, which when you don't have any pads on. And they perform totally differently when they're in pads in the game. So when you're watching film and you're seeing these 7-on-7 tournaments versus the actual film, how much weight do you put in either one?
Well, we definitely put weight into everything we see. And as you described, it's a little bit like in the NFL, putting weight into the combine. The combine is not 11-on-11 football, but you can also still evaluate a guy's fundamental traits. Is he sound technically? Does he like to compete? Does he have a work ethic? So those components can be evaluated, but you're right. It's no substitute for 11-on-11 football. And in terms of quarterbacks, there are some tremendous, a lot of them, quarterback coaches, quarterback trainers. So the young men playing quarterback in today's game are receiving excellent guidance and tutelage, and we're seeing the results on the field. I mean, there's a lot of good quarterback play at all levels of football currently, and it's just a blast for me to witness.
What is it that you look for in a quarterback in general? Like, is it the leadership? Is it height? Like, how much does height matter? How much does arm velocity? Because I noticed they measure how fast you can throw the ball. Like, how do those things factor in? Like, what are some of the key things that you look for when you're judging, when you're evaluating talent?
Well, I think to throw the football and be accurate, which is really the number one thing on your criteria list for quarterback, is to be accurate. You're looking for a consistent throwing motion. So we're looking for young men who can replicate their motion consistently. And they're not one time throwing three quarters, one time over the top. But a throwing motion needs to really minimize the moving parts like a golf swing does. So the way they keep their head still, they take a short stride, they emphasize the wrist movement of throwing. Those are parts of being a consistent thrower. So we're looking for those components. And then, of course, looking for a guy who's a good athlete. To throw a football, you need to be on balance. And not just on balance when your feet are set, but also on balance when you're on the run or your feet necessarily aren't set because the pocket may be disintegrating and your shelf life back there may be expiring. So we're looking for good athletes. And then once we can assess the physical part of a quarterback, we need to get to know them. We need to know what makes them tick. Can they process what they're seeing? They've got a great microchip there in their mind where they can process the defense and assess things in not just tenths of a second, but 100ths of a second, because that's how fast the game is. So there's mental aspects, of course, physical aspects, and then we start moving into the leadership aspects, because the quarterback position is one of the most important leadership spots in all the team sports.
Final question for you is, with that leadership, the quarterbacks obviously get a lot of praise and they get a lot of blame when you lose. But when you win, like Tom Brady, they'll say, oh, he's the greatest player of all time. And as a former quarterback, like where do you think the percentages stand in terms of like when a quarterback comes, like, and it's one guy is the quarterback of a roster and another guy's a quarterback of a roster. Like, how much do you think that the talent around him impacts his ability, and how much do you think he elevates the talent around him? A really good quarterback.
It's a two-way street. A quarterback needs his teammates, and the teammates need a quarterback, but it's a team game. And I don't agree with the assessment that a quarterback, you know, is responsible for wins, or that wins and losses should be associated with a quarterback or a nose guard or a free safety or Ray Lewis as the middle linebacker. It's a team game. This is not baseball where the pitchers, you know, for whatever reason, okay, the pitchers, they get wins and losses too. They shouldn't really get wins and losses either. Well, they're, especially in the American League or last year, they're not even batting. So what if he pitched a whale of a game, gave up one hit and lost 1-0? You know, it's a team game. So it's about your teammates and also how good a teammate you can be, both as a pitcher in baseball or as a quarterback in football. And the team is responsible for the wins and the losses. And as you've mentioned, George, you know, a quarterback can raise the level of his teammates if they believe in him. But you don't have to be a quarterback to be a leader. You could be the center. You could be the right guard. You could be the flanker, the split end, the tight end, the running back, the fullback, anything, the defensive end, the nose guard. So it's a team game, and that's what's beautiful about football is every team is different each and every year, and the leaders set the tone, they set the pace, they set the standard, they set the bar for the entire team to have, you know, memorable, important seasons.
You guys, he is Coach Bill Musgrave, the offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach at Cal. Find him on Twitter at Coach Musgrave. And if you're a recruit or a parent of a recruit or know a recruit or anything like that, this is I played under him. He was our OC in Jacksonville when I first got there. So I can attest to this man. He's a good man to play for. Coach, if Ace Wright, Two Jet Dragonfly still in the playbook?
Oh, yes. That might have been similar to the play that you beat the Titans with. Remember, Jaguars had never won in Nashville in the history of the franchise till you caught that shallow cross, took us in, then Fred Taylor scoring as time elapsed to finally beat those dastardly darn Titans. Jaguars finally got them that day. That was fun to be associated with you there in Nashville on that Sunday afternoon.
Absolutely. And Coach, much success this season, and especially in the non-conference versus Nevada and TCU. And I hope you win all your games except the one on October 15th in Eugene.
We got that one circled. You know that.
Absolutely. Well, good luck. Talk to you soon, Coach.
Thank you, George.
I hope you guys enjoyed the interview with Bill Musgrave. You guys, I'm George Reister. He's Ralph Amsden, and this is the Pac-12 Apostles. Make sure to hit us up on the Secret Textoso line and catch us next episode. Peace out. See you later.